assessing negotiating behavior. We're pleased to have with us an old friend, great colleague, Honorable Dick Solomon, who is the president of the U.S. Institute of Peace. I'm spending my time at Stanford. The World Affairs Council of Northern California invites you to join us in seeking knowledge and expanding your networks and discovering thoughtful solutions to global problems. To learn more about how to get involved with the Council and support its mission, you have cards on your seats, and I hope you'll refer to those. If you're unable to attend a program, we offer two excellent ways to stay connected. We have a weekly radio broadcast, It's Your World. They're on Monday evenings on KQED. And on our website, you can find an audio and video archive of all our past programs. Tonight's program is being recorded for radio, and we thank our engineer, David Ogilvie. Before we begin, it would be greatly appreciated if you would turn off your cell phones or any other electronic devices that might disturb the program. And please also note that there are on your chairs blue question cards. I'd encourage you to write your questions during Dick's remarks or immediately thereafter, and members of the staff will come by to collect them. Before we begin, I'd like to announce two upcoming programs that might be of interest to you. This Wednesday, on October 27th, the Council will host the editor of Foreign Affairs magazine, Gideon Rose, to discuss how American leaders have repeatedly ignored the need for careful post-war plannings throughout the 20th century. This event will be held in the World Affairs Council Auditorium at 6 p.m. Then on Thursday, October 28th, the Council will have Ian Frazier, a staff writer at New Yorker magazine, to discuss his extensive travels in Siberia over the last decade. This event will be held here at noon. Now it's my pleasure to introduce tonight's guest. I first met Dick Solomon nearly 40 years ago, I guess, when he was busy working on China, Taiwan, and other matters for Henry Kissinger at the National Security Council. He has been superbly trained with a PhD at MIT in political science and Chinese studies. He taught for some years at the University of Michigan. He headed the political science program at the RAND Corporation. He's had an exemplary career in government service. Beyond the NSC, he came back to the State Department in mid-'80s.
86.
To direct the State Department policy planning staff in the Reagan administration, and he subsequently served as East Asia and Pacific Assistant Secretary of State during the George H.W. Bush administration, did a stint as U.S. Ambassador in the Philippines, and now for a longer period than any of his predecessors, he has been leading the U.S. Institute of Peace. And he's not only put his stamp on the substantive program on subjects of the sort we'll discuss this evening, but he has also been responsible for gathering the funds and overseeing the design of a wonderful new building to which he has just recently taken title or occupancy. He'll move in shortly. It is across 23rd Street. It has a view on one side of the scintillating architecture of the State Department, and on the other side, a grand view of the Potomac and the Lincoln Memorial. I have no doubt where Dick will locate his own office when they move in March. It's a great pleasure to welcome Dick to the World Affairs Council of Northern California. He is speaking tonight about a book that you can acquire this evening called American Negotiating Behavior, Wheeler Dealers, Legal Eagles, Bullies, and Preachers. And I only got this on Saturday, so I haven't read the whole volume, but I can tell you I learned a lot, and I've spent most of 40 years working on this subject. So it's a great pleasure to welcome you, Dick, to speak on American negotiating behavior and the things that he learned in the course of studying not only our own negotiating behavior, but that of a score or more of other countries. Please.
Mike, thanks very much for your introduction. I won't go over some of the war stories that we've shared over our many years together as professionals and friends. What I'd like to do in our time this evening is to talk a bit about the book that we've just published on American negotiating behavior, but to relate it to some of the challenges that we now face as a country in adapting our foreign policy to what is a very new era in international affairs. And I'll talk a little bit about some of the changes that we're all confronted with. And then I'd also like to talk a bit about this institution that I've had the privilege of running since 1993, the U.S. Institute of Peace. It's a creation of Congress. Our annual program budget comes from a congressional appropriation. And we have a very broad charter of trying to deal with the world without always having to lead with our military capabilities. And what has happened, as I'll describe a bit in my remarks, is talk about the Institute as a change agent as our country struggles to deal with a very different era in international affairs. Let me, without going into a great deal of history, just take a broad perspective on the fact that we are in the fourth major transformation in international affairs in just over a century. World War I, World War II, the Cold War, and all the things that have transpired following the 9/11 events. Again, without going into a great deal of history, World War I, we broke out of the isolation and the self-preoccupation of the 19th century, became involved in international affairs, but then pulled back. The Congress rejected the League of Nations proposal of President Wilson, as you'll remember, went into another period of isolationism only to break out of it in 1941 when we were attacked, and then again pulled back. But not for long when the Cold War took hold with the Soviet subversion of Eastern Europe, the pressure on Turkey and Greece, the Korean War. The reason it's worth noting this history is because it relates to this issue of change. What's interesting is to compare the transition into World War II with what happened with the Cold War. In the case of World War II, virtually overnight with the attack at Pearl Harbor, we switched gears from this isolationist posture to one of industrialized warfare on a global scale. It was something that people didn't spend a lot of time thinking about. What we had to do seemed self-evident. Compare that with almost 15 years since, let's say, the Soviet subversion of Czechoslovakia through the Cuban Missile Crisis. Took us over a decade and a half to figure out how should we deal with the Soviet challenge. It was of a different character. Well, we're in a similar period following 9/11. All the debates that you can see in Congress, among the think tanks, in our press, trying to figure out what is really the character of the challenges to our national interests. And we, again, are in a period where the world is changing in a very fundamental way. And let me make use of some of the slides I brought up here. If you compare the world of the 21st century that we're now in with what the 20th century has given us, we all know about the imperial powers, the superpowers who had conventional military force that confronted us, Germany, Japan, and the Soviet Union. Today we deal with major states, but are they the same kind of challenge? We haven't figured out what's China all about. Is China really a threat to us? We know that it's primarily an economic, not a military problem to deal with. Weak and failed states are much more of the problem. Intrastate warfare. And instead of the conventional warfare that we lived with through the 20th century, we see our military trying to adapt to irregular warfare and the challenges of terrorism. And it's requiring a major restructuring of our military and intelligence services. During the Cold War, we had, of course, the nuclear standoff with the Soviet Union. Today, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, and our own adjustment to the world, one of the major security problems that we face is trying to deal with nuclear proliferation. It is a problem out of control, and as former Secretary of Defense William Perry, a good colleague who many of us work with, points out, if we can't get this issue under control, there are weapons of mass destruction lurking in this proliferation problem that will be a major security issue for everyone. The ideological rivalries that we live with during the Cold War era have been replaced by religious extremism and ethnic conflicts, as we've seen them particularly in Iraq, Afghanistan. It's much of the driver in what the Iranians are up to. And again, we're struggling to figure out how we deal with these new challenges. During World War II, civilians were the target of military action. Today, political activism, particularly in many populations in the Muslim world, have become weapons of attack, protecting Osama bin Laden, for example, and putting tremendous pressure on other societies. And there's been an enormous failure, what we refer to as public diplomacy. We don't know how to communicate with these very hostile publics who give support to adversarial countries. And then we deal with a range of issues that are not part of the classical character of diplomatic involvement. The economic interdependence that's come with globalization is leading to all the tensions that we now see with the Chinese and others on exchange rates as different countries try to adjust their economic activity to deal with the internal challenges of keeping people employed. Energy security and a range of issues generated by climate change, crop failures, these tremendous floods in Pakistan, the fires we saw last summer in Russia. Climate change is producing a range of issues that do have broad international impact. And again, we're struggling to deal with them. So we're in a period where we find the agencies of the U.S. government struggling to adapt to this changed international environment. The most adaptive of all the agencies has been our military, and particularly as we saw in response to the 9/11 attacks, the military has been the preferred agency of our national security constellation of organizations to deal with this changed world. And it's dealing with a situation that is increasingly raising concerns about what is referred to in many quarters as the militarization of U.S. foreign policy. And today we have the truly remarkable circumstance of a Secretary of Defense expressing deep concern about the degree to which the military is called upon to assume tasks that are really civilian in character. And in the summer of 2008, Secretary Bob Gates gave a very far-sighted speech when he said, and there's a quote up here on the projector, but I'll read it for our radio audience. Gates said, "Broadly speaking, when it comes to America's engagement with the rest of the world, it is important that the military is and is clearly seen to be in a supporting role to civilian agencies." And he went on to point out the need to adapt those civilian agencies to the world of the 21st century. And even more remarkable, Secretary Gates offered to transfer $700 million of Defense Department money to the State Department. The Congress decided that wasn't a transfer they wanted to support, but it is an interesting and a very significant example of a Secretary of Defense basically saying the civilians have to get out in front. We need to build what is generally referred to as the civilian capacity to deal with problems, including those we face today in Iraq and Afghanistan, by political means. Our military on the ground in those two countries keep saying these conflicts cannot be resolved by military means. We have to resolve them politically. And we have not seen the diplomats out in front in dealing with these problems. The professional military have expanded the ranks of their civilian colleagues, but the military has been out in front. And that is a situation that we are struggling to correct. Now that gets to the role of the Institute of Peace. And we were set up by Congress in 1984 precisely to strengthen ways of dealing with the world, not by military, but by political and economic measures, to find ways of preventing, managing, or resolving conflicts without having the military carry the major burdens of dealing with this very messy and transforming international environment. We're a pretty small agency. I think when we started out, our budget was $7 or $8 million a year. Today it is about $70 million. And we've grown because we have this very flexible charter from Congress that enables us to do innovative work where the big bureaucracies, state, defense, the intelligence communities, are again struggling in their bureaucratic ways to adapt to a very changed world. And we, the Institute of Peace, have been surprised at some of the things that have come our way that our progenitors in Congress never anticipated. For example, in 1994, I got a phone call one day from General Tony Zinni, a Marine Corps general. And I had known General Zinni a bit. He said, "We have a problem. The Clinton administration is sending the Marines on peacekeeping missions. Well, they're trained to shoot rifles, not to negotiate. Would you help us retrain them for these peacekeeping operations?" And so we began to do training activities that were, in effect, justified by our charter, but we did some rather innovative work in figuring out how do you take Marines and teach them how to negotiate with villagers or at checkpoints or with development officials in one or another country. We then went on and started training civilian police in the Balkans in the mid-90s. You remember that the Dayton Accords negotiated a settlement to the Balkans War. But then you had to stabilize the situation. And the State Department, for example, was finding it difficult to deal with the religious character of the conflict. The State Department does not have a Bureau of Religious Affairs. Well, the Institute of Peace had a program in religion and peacemaking. So I kicked my guys out of their offices, and they went over to the Balkans, and they helped the four religious communities in Bosnia-Herzegovina set up an interfaith council, and they helped stabilize the situation there, drawing on the support of the indigenous leadership that wanted to see the conflict ended. We're doing the same thing today in Iraq. We're doing it in the Middle East. Again, the State Department is asking us to do things that have just not been part of their traditional suite of activities. Which gets to the stack of books that I've laid on the table here to impress you with the extensive scholarship that we've been doing on negotiating behavior now for over 15 years. One of the things that, as the Institute of Peace has done its work, we were shocked to discover, is that our diplomats are not trained for what you would think is the primary skill of a diplomat, that is how to negotiate. The State Department has traditionally operated as a kind of mentoring organization, bright young guys or gals now would come along. They'd impress their seniors. They'd been would be brought into supporting roles, and they would learn on the job. But there was no formal training in the skills of negotiation. Well, Mike Armacost mentioned that my transition from being an academic to government work was working with Henry Kissinger in his national security role, where we opened the relationship with China. And what was interesting about that experience was that Kissinger, who, as you know, was trained as an academic in European politics, had dealt with the Soviet Union, was shocked during that secret trip that he took to China in 1971, that the Chinese were not just commies, were not just acting as communists in the pattern that he had observed it in the Soviet Union. They were really negotiating, dealing with him in classical Chinese traditional patterns. And after 5 years of observing Kissinger in that role, I went to the RAND Corporation, as Mike Armacost mentioned, and I did a study of how the Chinese had managed negotiating with the United States. And that started a series that now we've produced about a dozen books that look at how North Korea, Japan, Russia, France, Germany. We've just published a book on Iranian negotiating behavior, and one on Pakistan will come out shortly. Doing something that the State Department has not been able to or interested in doing. And then we now use these books in training programs, trying to build that civilian capacity to give our diplomats the capabilities, perspectives that are not part of their existing training. Which gets us to the most recent study that I've done in this series, which is a look at how Americans negotiate. Now, why would we look at our own negotiating behavior? Actually, that draws on a quote from the second century BC Chinese strategist Sun Tzu, who said that if you know your adversary and you know yourself, in 100 battles you'll be victorious. And so self-awareness, if you think about it, can be very helpful in dealing with people who on the other side of a negotiating table are anticipating how you're going to behave. Well, what did we find in this study? And by the way, I should point out that in looking at the American patterns, we didn't just stare at our own navels. We convened about 50-some foreign diplomats, foreign ministers, senior negotiators from countries all over the world who had dealt with American officials. And we asked them to tell us how we behave, because it usually takes the perspective, if you like, the cultural distance of a foreigner looking at someone from a very different culture and society to really identify what seems to be unique about behavior, in this case, negotiating behavior. And what did we find? And this is much of the guts of the books, the book that we're talking about tonight. And the first is a kind of shocking outcome. These foreign officials said, well, you Americans really don't negotiate. You tell us what your government is prepared to put on the table, but because you're a major world power, a superpower, or a hegemon, as some put it pejoratively, you just tell us what we've got to accommodate. And that was a consistent pattern that, frankly, made the American officials who we shared this information with feel very uncomfortable. Americans don't like to think of themselves as a bully, a hegemonic power, but that's not the way that our foreign counterparts tend to look at us. But of course, in reality, we do negotiate. And the interesting thing is that we spend almost all of our time negotiating with ourselves. That one of the fundamental aspects of this culture that we all share is that rivalries are just built into not only our culture, a very competitive culture, but the division of powers among the different agencies of the government are reflected in the shared and rivalry relationships among the State Department, the Treasury, the Defense Department, the intelligence agencies, and having done a fair amount of negotiating myself, I can tell you that if you're running a negotiation as an American diplomat, you're going to spend most of your time trying to build a consensus among your colleagues within the government. And it's out of that consensus, which is often hard fought and hopefully supported by the White House and Congress, that you come up with a negotiating position that you lay on the table to your foreign counterparts and tell them basically this is what you've got to live with. But Americans, in the eyes of these foreign officials, do get very high marks for being professional, for being well prepared, because this culture is really a can-do, problem-solving culture. And our diplomats get high marks for the degree to which they go into a negotiation trying to achieve some useful outcome. Put it in other ways, we're a transactional culture. We try to achieve deals and solve problems, which is very different when you go to a society like Japan, and Mike, you may want to say something about this, or China, whose culture is much more relational. That part of the, or a substantial part of the effort in negotiating a counter is to build a working relationship that hopefully will be the basis for the foreign official, the American or whomever, accommodating to their interests. And that was one of the primary conclusions we discovered in our study of how the Chinese dealt with Henry Kissinger. The Chinese ended up, after just two sessions with Kissinger, calling him a Lao Pengyo, an old friend. And of course, it's nice to be considered a friend, but in the Chinese cultural vernacular, a friend is not just there to be enjoyed as a counterpart. You're supposed to deliver. You're supposed to come through and accommodate the needs of your friends. So you acquire obligations in this relational arrangement that is rather different than the pattern that we're used to, where you're basically focused not on building the relationship, but on solving a problem. Which gets to the subtitles of this book that Mike Armacost read off. One of the unique things about our diplomatic system is the degree to which it's kind of open process. If you go to look at the foreign ministry in Japan or in England, let's say, they're rather closed systems. People start out their professional careers and they rise up to the senior levels. And there's very little what we refer to in our system as lateral entry. But we bring in talented people from many different professional communities to serve as senior diplomats or special envoys, which is how we get to what these foreign diplomats characterized as a kind of four-faceted face that American diplomats present to the world. Many of our most experienced diplomats, and indeed people brought into the service, have legal training. They're legal eagles with giving extensive attention to detail and to the legalities of agreements that are reached. Many also come out of the business community. They're wheeler dealers. They want to get a deal. And they're used to the negotiating pattern that leads to finding mutual interests and working out some existing accommodation. But moralizers are also a characteristic of many of our negotiators. I just saw former President Jimmy Carter being interviewed for his new book. He generally is identified as an example of a very moralizing leader, putting tremendous emphasis on human rights, values of freedom and democracy. But then there are also the hegemons. That is, those who particularly when we're under real pressure in terms of our fundamental security interests or economic concerns, who are seen as bullies or willing to invoke American power to achieve our national ends. Two other qualities that come out of this study are, one, how time urgent our negotiators are. Our system is driven by electoral cycles, as well as by the fact that most of our diplomats have 3, maybe 4 years in a given position. So whether you're a political official or a career diplomat, you only have a limited amount of time to produce some outcome of significance. And being, again, a can-do culture, people do want to achieve some outcome. And so our diplomats are time-driven in a way that cultures, foreign governments that do not have these electoral cycles just do not feel. And then finally, you get to the issue of hospitality. One of the things that I discovered with some interest was that when we went to China in the early 70s, our officials were confronted with the exquisite banquet routine of the Chinese. And I say only with a little bit of jest that if you want to shut down the ability of the Chinese government to run a negotiation, you send home their cooks. The Chinese build those personal relationships that make for old friends through their cuisine. We know it's one of the great cuisines of the world. Moreover, if you look at the comparative drinking behavior, something that you wouldn't think is part of diplomacy, when President Nixon went to China, he took a staff of 176, something like that. And Premier Zhou Enlai at the welcoming banquet, he had one little thimble of that fiery Mao Tai liquor, and he toasted every one of the American officials with that one little thimble. He would just wet his upper lip. Well, the Americans were throwing back the, and the Chinese try to get you drunk. Obviously, you're more pliable as a negotiating counterpart if you're feeling no pain. Compare that, let's say, with the Russian pattern. The Russians want to get drunk with you. Unfortunately, alcoholism is a significant issue in their society. The French try to impress you with their viniculture, with their fine wines. And when I was negotiating the Cambodia settlement, every time we'd have a meeting in Paris, we'd just be bowled over, woozy with this spectacular cuisine that they would treat us with every time we had a series of negotiations. So you find these cultural patterns worthy of analysis because they do affect the behavior. Now, how do Americans come out on hospitality? Congress doesn't like to have us use your tax money for good hospitality. And one of the embarrassing things, frankly, about running a negotiation is our diplomats do not get a very adequate budget for doing the kind of hospitality that we encounter from our counterparts. Again, we're transactional. Get the deal done. Don't lay it on thick with the good cuisine and the hospitality, which is, as I say, is an embarrassment to many of our diplomats. So this is the set of cultural patterns, the institutional context that we confront as we're dealing with this very different world of the 21st century. And one of our great challenges is to bring about change to the way we deal with the world. And so that we'll leave some time here for questions and answers, I won't go on to quote an addition from Secretary Gates, who points out the need to increase dramatically the spending that Congress will invest in our diplomacy, but it is one of the great challenges that we now face, which gets me to the role of the Institute of Peace as a change agent, as a small institution that has the flexibility to do some interesting research, which then we use now to change the way that we train our military, train our diplomats. And we started out in a townhouse just opposite the White House. Today we're housed in a bit of commercial real estate called the National Restaurant Association building. Because our work has been recognized as having some interesting impact, Congress gave us one of the last building sites on the Mall at the corner of 23rd and Constitution Avenue. It's what we refer to as the War and Peace Corner of the National Mall because it's right opposite the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. The Lincoln Memorial stares right at this, what is now our building. I'll show you what it looks like in a minute. It's a 2-minute walk from the Korean War Memorial. And if you walk up the National Mall, you pass the World War II Memorial and get to the Holocaust Memorial Museum. And our work is meant to contrast with the tremendous sacrifices that our country has made in war, in the hopes that we can learn to deal with the world in a less destructive way. This is, if you go to the corner of 23rd and Constitution today, this is what you'll see. This building was just finished last week, and every cab driver in the city, since we're on the main access route in from Reagan National Airport, now refers to the Peace Building, and it's where our work will now be housed in a permanent basis. Hopefully, because of this facility, we will have significantly greater impact in the way that our country deals with the world. Now, finally, let me just say that the Institute, again, is a pretty small operation. How do you really bring about fundamental change in the way that we organize ourselves to deal with the world of the 21st century? And I would just point out that two initiatives of times past that are worth looking at emphasize the need for Congress to be really at the center of efforts to transform the way we organize and fund our diplomacy. In 1954, as the Cold War took hold, the president of Brown University, Henry Wriston, formed a commission that recommended some fundamental changes in the way that we organize and deploy our diplomats. And in the late 60s, Senator Barry Goldwater and Congressman Nichols, I forget his first name, passed some legislation that brought together the military services, which had sustained inter-service rivalry for decades, and created the Goldwater-Nichols ground rules for inter-service coordination, which created the Joint Chiefs, made the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff today, Admiral Mike Mullen, the primary military advisor to the president, and enabled our military to work together in much more coordinated fashion. Well, we need a similar effort organized by Congress to transform the way that we structure and deal with the world, the way we train our diplomats. And hopefully the work of the Institute of Peace can, in substantive terms,
contribute to that degree of transformation in the way that we deal with the world of the 21st century. Well, thanks very much for your attention, and I'll look forward to your questions.
Thank you very much, Dick, for very thoughtful remarks. We have about 20 minutes for discussion. Let me begin with a couple of questions that came with regard to Afghanistan. One is, many are calling for a diplomatic surge to rebuild civil society and the rule of law there. What does a diplomatic surge look like to you, and how would it unfold? What can it accomplish? And an additional question, what's the difference between negotiating with a sovereign state on the one hand and a movement or local authorities on the other? How do you prepare people for those two quite different tasks?
The challenge we face today in Iraq and Afghanistan, as we've discovered after a better part of a decade dealing with these conflicts, is we're not going to change overnight the culture of these societies. What we are doing, the Institute, and what our military is very much involved in, is trying to identify local leaders, local organizations that basically want to stabilize their society. In 2004, the 10th Mountain Division, which was fighting in Diyala Province, came to the Institute of Peace. We have an office in Baghdad, and said the local sheikhs, Shiite and Sunni, are fed up with fighting with one another. Would you, the Institute of Peace, help them negotiate a settlement agreement so that they can stop fighting and stabilize their area? And so over a four-month period, we negotiated with these local leaders and produced a settlement which helped to bring about the so-called Anbar Awakening. And virtually overnight, violence against our troops ended. And at least in that one limited part of Iraq, we, the Institute of Peace, were able to work with our military to bring the local leaders together to stabilize their local communities. And that's a pattern that we, at a very modest level, are replicating in certain parts of Afghanistan. Property disputes in both countries are a major source of violence. And so we have helped set up local tribunals where people who do have local folks who have property disputes can adjudicate their conflicts rather than shoot at one another. We've trained conflict managers at Baghdad University who go out in their own societies and try to resolve issues that otherwise would lead to violence. And it's in that way that we, the Institute, and our military, try to identify elements in these societies who, again, want to promote reconciliation. Which gets to the second part of your question. Classic diplomacy was a matter of officials, foreign service officers, diplomats dealing basically with their counterparts. And one of the things that's happened in the international environment of our time is that there are many agencies and groups and social elements involved in diplomacy. And so a diplomat has to deal with many more than just counterpart diplomats from counterpart governments. Partly it's dealing with international organizations. And as Mike Armacost may attest, normally through much of the 20th century, our diplomats basically dealt on a one-to-one basis with officials from a counterpart, one government. Today, international organizations have to play a much greater role in dealing with the problems that I outlined in my talk. So multilateral diplomacy is one of the challenges that our diplomats face. But then we find that in trying to
stabilized, let's say, Iraqi society, non-governmental humanitarian assistance organizations playing a major role bringing social services to Iraqi society, or the same thing in Afghanistan. Classic foreign service pattern is not to see the NGOs, the non-governmental organizations, as part of their range of collaborators in trying to promote a diplomatic settlement. We have to negotiate with the bad guys. While it's not talked about or it's dealt with indirectly, we're promoting negotiations with the Taliban today. You know, there were serious negotiations dealing with the hostage takers in the Gulf of Aden who were grabbing a hold of ships and holding them for ransom as a way of making money and promoting their causes. Well, you can't just shoot at these people. You've got to try to bring about negotiated settlements. Well, formally we say we don't negotiate with hostage takers or terrorists, but in fact you do. And we need to train our diplomats for dealing with these non-conventional forms of diplomacy.
We've got a lot of questions, which is testimony to the interest that you stimulated. Let me turn you to another part of the world. To what extent are American negotiating characteristics driven by lobbyists and domestic politics, for example, our current efforts to engage Israelis and Palestinians in the peace process?
The American Congress and the private groups who seek to pursue their interests through lobbying activities, either with Congress or with the White House, play a major role in influencing our patterns of diplomacy. One of the standard complaints about American diplomats is that our negotiators will work up a deal. It'll go to the White House, or Congress will pick up wind of what the deal looks like. And lobbying groups will intervene and say to their senator, their congressman, say to the White House, looks like a bad deal, we've really got to do more. And so one of the characteristics of our negotiating behavior is we refer to as moving the goalposts. And so our diplomats will work out a deal. You get these political interventions, and our diplomats have to go back to their counterparts and say, oops, sorry, the deal we worked out isn't enough, and you really have to modify it in one way or another. And so our political system does produce these very unusual and to many foreign governments frustrating patterns of negotiating deals only to find that the bottom line didn't stick, and you have to go back to renegotiate a deal. Another thing that's very frustrating to foreign diplomats, the Chinese particularly found it very frustrating, when you build a negotiating pattern around personal relationships, what happens when the American diplomat gets reassigned after 3 years? The Chinese were very frustrated that they'd build these old friendships. The American diplomats would be reassigned, and they'd have to start all over again. That's just, again, one of the patterns of our diplomatic practice that is rather frustrating to foreign counterparts.
But they had an institutional memory of what had gone on in the last round, and our new guy may not have.
And that's one of the costs that we bear. Exactly right.
To another region. In the preface to your book, you mentioned China's negotiating behavior. Could you contrast the way in which the Chinese approached the, I think it was the EC-3 plane incident with the U.S. back in 2001, and the way in which they displayed their toughness against Japan in the Senkaku maritime incident of a few weeks ago?
Well, there are two interesting things worth pointing out. In our country, it took us decades to organize inter-service collaboration. I mentioned the Goldwater-Nichols pattern.
the Chinese are dealing with a situation where they, a country that has not been very active on the world scene in the past century and more, don't have the internal structure to keep their military under control. And as best we can tell, the EP3 incident was brought about by a local Air Force unit that was unhappy about the coastal surveillance flights that our military carry out as they try to maintain a stabilizing military presence in the Western Pacific. And so it was a kind of cowboy Air Force unit that produced that incident, which, as you'll remember, a Chinese Air Force plane collided with one of our surveillance planes. The Chinese plane went down and produced a major diplomatic incident. As best we can tell, the Chinese political leadership was deeply embarrassed by that event, and the Chinese are still struggling to try to deal with the internal management of their military forces and to integrate them into their diplomatic practice. In the case of the recent tensions with Japan, one of the things that is happening in China is that the power of nationalism is reasserting itself in some very forceful ways. We all know about the legacy of Second World War as a result of Japan's invasion of China and all that happened during the Pacific War period. The memories of that experience are very raw in the minds of the Chinese. And a sense of nationalism is very strong and is now asserting itself in terms of offshore disputes over territorial waters and the resources in the Western Pacific, the East and the South China Seas. And I was in China just a few months ago, and several Chinese think tank folks, people who analyze the world and their own dealings with it, point out that public opinion in a society that is becoming mobilized through the internet, through modern communications, is generating a much more forceful public expression of that sense of nationalism, and it's the Chinese leadership is having some real challenges trying to contain it and not have it drive the government in ways that could be very counterproductive in terms of China's relations, not just with Japan, but with us and with other countries in the region.
You just referred to the internet. One question is, could you talk about how the U.S. Institute of Peace can leverage the internet in the accomplishment of your mission, and what do you hope for in using global communications capabilities over the next 5 years to advance your cause?
It's an excellent question, and frankly, one of our frustrations, since I can say this just to the north of Silicon Valley, is we've been trying to influence, or interest rather, many of the information technology companies in this part of our country to support our work, because we have a center of innovation, as we call it, that is looking at how the internet, teleconferencing, and other communication technologies give our work greater outreach. Just to give you one brief example from the early 90s, the humanitarian assistance organizations don't like to collaborate too closely with our military. Because the fact that they can be seen as neutral parties bringing public service to bear is essential to their being effectiveness. But they need transportation support, they need security, they need communications that only our military provides. And so one of the things the Institute has done is in its early years, we set up communication networks built around the internet where the military could communicate with the humanitarian assistance organizations and coordinate their activities. And then we thought, aha, the internet's going to be a great vehicle for promoting this kind of new diplomacy. The unfortunate problem was that the bad guys were learning how to use the internet as well. And one of the interesting books we published is called Terror on the Internet, which looks at how terrorist organizations have learned to use the internet for propagandizing, for fundraising, for coordinating their activities. But these technologies, which do cut both ways, are built into our new headquarters facility. And thanks to a recent philanthropic gift, we are installing high-definition teleconferencing capabilities, which will enable the Institute to basically project its programming on an interactive basis, not just anywhere in this country, but anywhere in the world. And so if you don't mind getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning, you can run a collaborative program with China or with Indonesia, or with getting up a little later with countries in the Middle East through these new teleconferencing capabilities. And this is, without question, the wave of the future. We know that the internet, cell phones, as with fax machines before them, are transforming the way that people interact. And we intend to use these capabilities for our education and training work, for research collaborations. And I'm confident that we will not be the only ones doing this. We will be building electronic networks of research and training collaborators as we advance our work.
To refer back to an earlier question, I happened to be in Afghanistan for the first time in January, and they were talking about a civilian surge and a development and diplomatic component to the diplomacy that would involve sending 1,000 people to Afghanistan over the course of the year. Right. And you've just referred to the difficulty of making that civilian face apparent when they have to be embedded in military units. But I wondered if USIP has been involved at all in the training of those kind of people, and if it's possible, when you're under the gun, to get folks out into the field quickly to be assured they have the cultural sensitivities and linguistic training to be effective.
There are two things that I can point to that we've done. First, when the Institute initially got involved in Iraq, we were asked by the Defense Department to do interviews with our officials at all levels who had operated on the ground in Iraq, and to analyze their experience and develop the kind of briefings, training is maybe a little too heavy, which would convey that cultural sensitivity. We're doing the same thing now in Afghanistan. Our purpose is not to, which we say, have Americans out in front dealing with these problems, but rather to train local people to build the capacity for them to deal with the problems in their society, reconstituting civil society organizations, negotiating settlements to problems on their own behalf. And what we have found, and it's really gratifying, is that in both these societies, despite the horrendous violence, the fact that local folks who collaborate, work with Americans or the international forces there are often targeted for violence by the bad guys. We found more than we can handle Iraqis and Afghanis who want to be trained to deal with the political reconciliation side of conflict management in their society. So our work on the ground is promoting this kind of local training.
With the clock moving, let's consider this the last question. It's one I think a lot of folks on the radio will also be interested in. What advice do you have for a college student interested in pursuing a career in diplomacy, and specifically what can students do now in order to prepare themselves for a future career in negotiation?
Well, we don't have a lot of them, but the Institute of Peace does give out scholarships for advanced training in the kind of work we do. Actually, we start out in the high schools. We have a yearly national peace competition. Our board of directors selects some kind of a war and peace issue in high school. We get 7,000 or 8,000 kids from all around the country writing essays on some war or peace theme. And that's the way we try to draw young kids into our orbit. Then we give postdoctoral fellowships. And if you're interested in diplomacy, as I suggested in my remarks, going to work for the State Department or AID is not the only way to do it. The Treasury Department is heavily involved in diplomacy. Almost any non-governmental organization involved in international affairs is a great place to do humanitarian assistance work on behalf of some very important causes. International organizations, both regional and the UN, hire people. So we're in a time when there are many organizations involved in international affairs, including the business community, who can play a role in hopefully promoting economic development and political stabilization. We don't often think of the business community as an important element of our diplomacy, but as anyone who's looked at the economics will tell you, our AID programs, while they do have a certain effect, have nothing like the impact on economic development of the business community. And so working for an international business enterprise that is investing in and creating productive enterprises in one country or another can play a major role in promoting stabilization and advancement in economic progress and living standards. So there are many ways to engage in the world, and the people who are interested in the role of the Institute in its many programs play in that activity should go to our website, usip.org, www.usip.org, and you'll find we have a website that will lay it all out in great detail.
Thank you very much, Dick, both for your remarks this evening and for the great work you've done in transforming USIP into a great national institution. That concludes our program for this evening, but I want to remind you that Dick will be signing some books. Now, this has forewords to demonstrate the breadth of its appeal, written by Madeline Albright and Condi Rice, and has very enthusiastic blurbs from Henry Kissinger and George Shultz.